Now recording, red. Yeah, good. So after having had some conversations with Mary and Ed, I feel already very much at home here, since there is this intermingling of deeply societal issues with the issues of soul and imagination. Usually when I speak other places, such as Norwegian Business School or MIT's Law of Management, or this, I base my work more in the empirical psychology, because that's more accessible to economists and other people. But here, I would much prefer, rather than starting with the mainstream and social psychology issues or approaches to climate, so I want to invite you to come with me into the, dip into the deep end, or the third part of this this book. So my plan is actually just to do a little reading, and then open up for Q&A. And also, I have a standard slides presentation, or overheads, as they say. If you can't use your head, use the overhead. But I prefer us to use our heads. Yeah. So. I hope you're okay with that. So being both an economist and a psychologist, I think, guess the question that has been driving me over the last 25 years is, are we humans inevitably short-term, so to speak? Because that's a kind of feedback I get from many physicists and natural science people, that we seem to be hardwire in our genes to kind of bring down the Earth's biosphere with us. And I would also like to put the question a little bit differently, more positively maybe, that is, under which conditions will humans act for the long term? Yeah. And that's what this book really tries to address, in terms of the psychology of climate. And after having gone through all the social psychology and the cognitive psychology and the evolutionary psychology, etc., and also the solutions that are emerging from a broad suit of the social sciences, I think I come to what I perceive as the most fundamental answer to that question in the chapter that I would like to read a little bit from to you. So, this is a chapter called Reimagining Climate. It had been soggy and cold for days on end. Our water bottles freezing at night, despite the fact that it was August. The higher reaches of Sarek National Park in Sweden can have Arctic conditions, even in summer. Still, the three of us had some great days of hiking from our base camp in the magnificent untouched alpine area with sharp peaks and glaciers, and despite the heavy clouds, the fog, the rain, and the sleet around us. On our last day there, we were roped in and walking up a glacier to ascend the highest peak, Grandfather Mount Sarek himself. But with the heavy clouds hanging overhead, I thought, what is the point? There is no chance of seeing anything at the top, anyway. My older brother, however, he's an utter peak maniac. He wants up, no matter what, just to have been there. So, after traversing the glacier, we started climbing the narrow shoulder of Mount Sarek, heading upward into the ever thicker fog. The cliffs were barren and drizzling all over. We could hardly see 40 feet up or down. Futile madness in grey porridge. Finally, we spotted something whitening above our heads. We had no idea how far up we'd gotten. Then, the air decided to show us some of its wizardry. As if we'd finally passed some kind of initiation test. It drew an amazingly sharp top line off the clouds. The peak of Mount Sarek extended up above them like a huge shark fin, swimming among endless white waves. As we approached the top 50 feet, the wind we'd struggle against farther below was nowhere to be found. The stones at the peak were warm and dry, and the brilliant sun we hadn't seen in a week was all around us. The smell of sun-dried lichen wafted up from warm granite, and it was so warm we had to strip off all our clothes to the waist. We were stunned. The 20 plus other peaks around us had all been magicked away. Nothing but our little patch of mountain was in sight. It was as if the world were suddenly made of solely bright, white, fluffy stuff. The deep blue above and this dark, moving shark fin. We had to be careful not to fall off. My friend Mats wanted to take a picture with his mobile so he could send home to his wife. But there was no coverage, of course. He snapped away, but when we came back, he discovered the memory card had failed. So this active worlding, this creation of a unique place in that moment, remains now only as an embodied memory. I can still feel it. We never captured it on any flat, two-dimensional photo, nor could we even have, if the camera had worked. What happened was that through surprising shifts, the air showed its powers to hide, create, reveal, and whisk out of sight again anything really, even massive 7,000 foot mountains. Usually, the air is just the invisible background of our everyday life. We do not notice it. But when smoke, fog, tornadoes, wind, snow, violent rain, or delicate dawn envelops us, we're reminded that the air is continuously bringing forth worlds inside which our bodies live. In certain Norwegian rural dialects, it's still common on a stormy day to hear, "He blows hard today." By personifying the air or the wind, we come to a closer relationship with it. "Personifying is the heart's mode of knowing," says James Hillman. "The invisible background may then become a clear foreground figure whose actions stand out more clearly." So the air is no object. If anything, it's a grand subject to which we are subjected. We are intimately connected to the air and others through our breathing. And the air entering our own lungs and bloodstream now has been carried by these winds around the entire earth. But in the conventional modern view, the air is nothing but a mix of gases like nitrogen, oxygen, argon, and their now infamous cousins, carbon dioxide and methane. Stripped of wonder, it just passively fills empty space. In this reductionist mindset, the atmosphere is a complex system that behaves in unpredictable ways, but can still be approximated and appropriated by modeling, we believe. It may behave chaotically, but it is precluded from being seen as having a mind of its own. In the single vision of science, as poet William Blake would say, it is not a person, it is not a friend, it is not a big breath breathing us, thinking its cloud thoughts as they shift toward the horizon. The three parts of this book, called Thinking, Doing, and Being, are partly inspired by Aristotle's distinction of the three fundamental activities of psyche: theoria, thinking, praxis, doing, and poiesis, being. Poiesis really means knowing by creating. Something is brought into being, and the one who's creating is also brought forth in the act of the making. Anyone who's done any sort of improvisation has experienced poiesis in an exemplary way. In the creative process, new knowing simply arises. The dance arrives through the body's spontaneous movement, and the jazz musicians follow the flow of music into uncharted territory. The poet has to catch the poem before it flies away. All these are instances of knowing by bringing into being. And we've seen how both conventional science and everyday opinion regards air not as something our psyche participates in, but as something out there, beyond us, the climate. We relate to it by observing it with measuring instruments, looking nearsightedly at computer models and graphic weather forecasts on the screen. We tend not to think much about the scents it carries, the breeze it brushes across our skin when we feel its shifting wind patterns. Nor is there any gratitude for the air, to the air, for our very existence. We've distanced ourselves so much from the living air that only its revolt against us can break open that shell and dissolve the psychological distancing. But what would happen if we thought about climate disruptions as the air's poiesis? The air is continually playful in the way it moves. It blows, it moans, roars, whispers, or mumbles into the ears of each animal, carrying sounds from far away. It sings with the leaves and hosts infinite patterns of light. Smell, sound, energy, and other waves. The air overflows with information, patterns, voices, dynamically interacting with itself and with us. What might happen if we stopped viewing the air as a blank canvas for carrying our radio waves or hosting our weather or bringing us the voice of our crying baby, but, as Mount Sarek taught me, instead viewed it as the active imagination of the world? As Mount Sarek taught me, seeing the air as the active imagination of the world. The fascinating thing is how it connects and intermingles with us and our psyche. We do find hints in our language that this concept wasn't always overlooked. You may well know that the word psyche primarily harks back to breath and the big breath. It comes from Greek psuche, meaning breath, life, soul. It is also related to the verb psuko, to blow, as the wind. Thus, psychology is really to give an account, logos, of our life breath. And similarly, spirit is from Latin spiritus, of course, which also means to breathe. And that's why we have words such as inspire, respire, expire, in addition to spiritual. It's why we have called certain moods low or high spirits. And the spirit world thus refers to the worlds of the wind and the air. In most of modern psychology, however, the psyche, or more commonly the mind, applies to what is assumed to happen only inside the skull, as if the breath, as if the body and air do not participate. Carl Jung put psyche at the center of his work, yet he struggled to clarify his thoughts and concepts about it in his entire life, particularly with how to limit or locate the psyche. Perhaps his most eloquent and unequivocal formulation is from his commentary on The Secret of the Golden Flower, where he says, "The psyche is no more inside us than the sea is inside the fish." This is pretty potent. We are all swimming in a sea of psyche. It surrounds us on all sides, but we do not notice it. If, as Jung also said, that psyche creates reality every day, and further, that we are as much inside the psyche as the fish are inside the sea, then we are forced to rediscover psyche as breath and air. Every morning, it is air that lets light through to bring forth another day. In this daily labor of creation, the ground, the earth, the ocean, and the waters, and the sun's fire give, of course, vital contributions. Then they all meet in this exquisitely sensitive and reflective medium to create a new day, inside which we may go to work and think nothing of it. Imagination, then, does not lie solely in the human brain. Imagination lives in the greater world, within each being and outside of it. It is an exchange and plays out in the world around us, hosted by the air. Thus, my awareness is participating in and co-creating the larger field of awareness in the forest. So today, in the midst of climate disruptions, it may be high time that we recover and remember this sense of the air as, in its own way, alive and sentient. The fact that we have forgotten the air, replacing it with the abstract concept of gases, also explains our irreverence for what we now call the atmosphere. We have forgotten that the air is a sacred, intelligently creative being. Our societies are unthinkingly letting it receive all our wastes, filling the air with exhaust, fumes, smoke, dust, chemical compounds, airplanes, and noise. Is it any surprise that the air, having tolerated this behavior for too long, now is violently shifting into another mode altogether? So the air and I, some practical implications. All this philosophy about the air and awareness may seem speculative and academic. What difference does it make if awareness is inside our skull or continuous with the air? Well, it's no remarkable insight at this time to realize that humanity is now on the way to disrupting biodiversity and the climate. We've been pretty busy with that for some centuries already. What is remarkable is that some humans are beginning to wake up, as from a centuries-long slumber, to rediscover our intimate relationships to air, sea, forest, ourselves, and one another. I think my point is that this is all about reawakening to wonder, seeing the air with new eyes. There is magic in the air if we attend to it. This is not extra reality magic or superstition. There is no need for extra sensory perception or parapsychology or appropriation from other cultures' spiritual traditions. For us, Westerners, it is about reawakening to the surprising creativity that the air is performing. That it is performing in front of our very but wary eyes. The shifting clouds, the endless colors of dawn, rainbows and fog, all this is a form of everyday magic. It is the magic of the real, not the supernatural. But to really notice it, our perception must shift a little. Take, for instance, our attitudes to clouds. They're not just pretty or heavy, as heat shields, as living duvets for our planet, and water transport. They are critical, not just to our hydropower, but to our survival. Without them, the sun would obliterate life. And they draw our imagination. We see elephants and twisted horse heads and all manner of images in their billowing woolly whiteness as they shapeshift above us. They wander their own ways, awakening our never-ending wonder. And this continues creating and recreating. The free play of the skies is also happening in our awareness as we contemplate the clouds moving, or the way a butterfly bounces along, or the way morning mist slides through the trees. Thus, if it is only up to me or us to act on the climate and counter the climate destruction, then hopelessness can and will sneak in. We may feel little reason for optimism in the grips of our drought. We're so small. If, however, we're teaming up with the air and its continuous worlding, then we may feel we act in resonance with a larger context, a larger flow. But aligning myself with this larger wind, I gain deeper connectedness. I am the wind talking through my throat. And therefore, I'd better be careful with my speech. I am part of air caring for itself. Am I helping or hurting it? I am part of a billion-year-old being starting to implement the necessary adjustments. The shift to realizing that we are deeply embedded in the living air is the deep reframing of climate communications. The shift to realizing that we are deeply embedded in this living air is the deep reframing for climate communication. I hardly see anyone today in the climate discourse speaking of the air as something beautiful, enchanted, sacred, except maybe some on the fringes of society, often dismissed as crazies. But unless we bring in this ancient aspect, the awe for the air, we'll lose something central and powerful, a sense of the sacred that can be critical for motivating us in the highly needed transition that makes climate no longer just distant, but into something very near, very personal, no longer abstract, technical, chemical. For all the amazing things the air does, and daily, it deserves such a sense, no matter how we choose to name it or understand it. Heaven, holy wind, great spirit, the openness of being, the imagination, or simply the air. For otherwise, why bother for a dead blob of gas? So, walk into a forest and reimagine the exchange and fine-tuned communication everywhere around you. The complex interaction of bird calls, dew, pollen, and pheromones. Dense patterns of light, sound, smell, and more. All hosted and held and mixed by the air. Or the next time you walk into a strong wind, play with it. Say hello by leaning into it and letting it move you. Or just feel the delight when the gentle afternoon breeze rustles your hair. We're held. As the children of this great spirit hovering over land and waters, we might even feel loved, not only by friends and family, but also by this magnificent being of clarity and light. Therefore, first and last, there is gratitude in the act of reimagining the air. It is gratitude for the life. It always has and always will nourish. That was the part of the book that I felt fitted best into this place, where I also feel at home to such an extent. And I have, as I said, slides that do the mainstream psychology, but because it also have to move into action, and we have to act in ways that we know changes culture. But this is the deep motivation that I wanted to share with you. This is why I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. This is why I'm giving my life to this this task. Mm. So I don't know where you want to go. Questions or comments or reflections or Ed.
It was interesting that one word I didn't hear in this wonderful talk, rich, poetic talk, was the word element. And I just wanted to ask you your reflections on the fact that the ancient world, the Greeks at least, thought air as one of the main elements. And in fact, Anaximenes claimed in a famous sentence, a fragment, all is air. I wonder if you could reflect on that. In other words, it sounds like there was an early realization of the pervasiveness and depth and elemental presence of air already at that moment. Then somehow, apparently, we lost it. And it seems like your work in this talk, which I think is very parallel to Bachelor's great book on air and dreams, is an effort to restore that sense of air as elemental, where the word element doesn't mean chemical element or anything like that, but really basic constituent of the known world or the experienced world.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just wanted to have reflections on that curious fate of air, much appreciated but then lost. Now you're attempting to encourage us to rediscover it. I don't know whether you still call it an element, but you call it a being once or twice, which is intriguing.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Ed. I'm sure I have the word element in there somewhere. It just happened not to come out in the selection I did. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to reflect on that. And I think what makes the ear special as an element, and which might make it primer in a phenomenological sense, is that it's the one element we're inevitably immersed in first. So to be born is to be born into the air, not just individual, but also to be is to be in the air, I would say. And also, I like this image of, if you, with the, oh, did we lose the picture? Oh, here we go. I just want to have that over. Okay. So if we travel in from outer space, so to speak, and then think about what is the air, if you imagine that we're coming down, the outer space is really a very opposite of dense.
Light,
yeah, or very expanded state of plasma. In according to the natural sciences, matter can exist in one of four states, and it's plasma, gas, liquid, and the solid state. And as you kind of descend through the atmosphere, you transition from somewhere between a plasma and entering into the fluidity of gas. And then, as you get closer to Earth, there is the waters and there is the all-too-solid being. And it's only like a very thin layer, about 6 to 7 miles, that is breathable air. And in this, the effects of plasma, the effects of solid state, the effect of liquid water, all mixes and are held by the air. Without the air, the water will go away, and the plasma would kind of smother the hard thing. So there would be no water and no fluidity. And inside this thin, vulnerable film, everything we know about life has come into being. And this is the sense I get when I hear all is air. As again, and thank you, Ed, because I should have sent you this before, but I would love to have that in there, but it's not. But now, so in the second edition, if ever, that quote will have a prominent place. It's beautiful, because it is an early reflection on this element of the air that is now fully confirmed by whatever we know about the natural sciences and how precarious and how unique our air is. There is no other planet that we are aware of that have anything similar to the air we are having. Yes?
I appreciate you pointing out kind of the specialness of this layer. And also, I'm struck by the fact that our very breathing in and out is also contributing to that layer.
Very much so. Participating in its dance. It goes into our bodies and does its wind thing in our lungs and then comes out again and continues to dance as your nostrils exhales. So there's this, you know, incredibly intimate, incredibly fine-tuned participation, mutual participation. So thanks. Yes?
I just really liked your positing that basically the air holds the psyche itself, or is perhaps the psyche itself, and that I think it's really interesting looking at that idea in the context of our search for life outside of our atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now, not to say that I believe that there isn't life out there, mm-hmm. but that if in our vast search there hasn't been anything that we found outside of that air, and that would, and even when we go out, you know, as astronauts or these people go out, they bring the air with them, you know, and that allows them to continue to participate in the psyche, to have that air with them.
Exactly.
Go out without the air.
Exactly. You know, exactly. Spot on.
So then it makes me, and then, you know, even if we were to discover some other sort of being that existed out in life outside, I don't think it would be necessarily part of our same psychic sort of field. It would be kind of this different engagement, I think. So that's really interesting that you.
Mm. So yeah, and to reflect on that, I think this aspect that I'm trying to bring into the front here is something that's completely lacking from the climate discourse, which is so focused on declaring the petroleum industry the enemy and doomsday and hard action, that there is no room for this gratitude or the experiential domain of how the air is actually, it's not out there, it's really us. Please.
It's very poetic, and I'm reminded of a lot of different writers. Rilke, who wrote that the sky doesn't cease to be heaven until we breathe it. And also stations of St. Francis that I encountered in northern Italy on a mountain trail, where one of them was dedicated to Brother Wind.
Exactly, exactly.
But also there's something that saddened me about the poesis that you're engaging in, because it almost sounds a little bit like a swan song. It almost sounds a little bit like, you know, let us shift. The inevitable is happening. The ocean temperatures are rising. We may have a limited amount of time on this planet. Let us shift almost dimensions into this. What seems also a little bit like a participation mystique, you know, a union with, by allowing it to breathe through you, to becoming you. So has that, any of that occurred to you too, that your shift is not just bringing in another perspective, but maybe also something about preparing for another way of being almost?
Thank you. That's a very, very. Thank you for listening. The way of listening was. So, what I did not share was from a chapter that I took the title from a quote of James Hillman in the book We've Had 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World is Getting Worse. It's a phrase I love. It says, "Stand up for your depression." And in this chapter, I'm looking at what I call the deep grief, or the sense of leaving behind something, or the loss and the destruction that we are currently enacting, and how our souls are reacting to that, not just personally, but connecting to the feelings in this land. And just driving down here yesterday, I really felt overwhelmed at some point, driving through some areas where I perceived the grief of those dying oaks. And having just read that, I think there's 12 million trees now dead in California so far. And I think this grieving or mourning, or that comes to us when we get into the participation mystique with the, or not just the air, but the ecosystems, the forests themselves, are significant in terms of the shift that is happening. And I don't want to go into a literal doomsday or apocalypse about this, but it is inevitably that we are shifting it. And in a Hillman way, how can we hold that depression, that darkness, that grief, and letting it do its work on us, without either losing all hope or becoming maniacs in maniac active, to kind of try to fix everything in the heroic mode. But what does it mean to be truly witness to the great grief of nature and feeling its grief in our bodies? Yeah, Steve?
Oh, thank you for that. I appreciate that. I just got back from St. Louis, and I was offering something about this perspective, the land dream. And the biggest fear and the grief there has to do with air. Because in that place, it's just too toxic. Right? It's 75% of the children now in the schools are inhalers. Air, 75%. I mean, so every kid is noticing somebody next to them. But, so, you know, that whole anxiety is alive and active. Now, the problem was, they said, look, can you come on over? We're going to invite a lot of environmental leaders, which they did, a lot of city people, which they did, a lot of decision makers and policy makers, which they did, all in conversation, right? And the idea is everything that we've tried hasn't helped move us into something more constructive in terms of initiatives that we can take to actually help clean the air. Even kids and survival was not somehow moving the position. So I really got interested in what you were just offering, which has to do with, you know, maybe there's a different direction to go. Maybe it's not about just the science of it. Maybe it's not only about the kind of, you know, coming into rallies and this and that. Social action has to be rooted in something else, something imaginal, psychological, the actual experience of despair or grief. And so it's from that place, on behalf of all those folks, just with your reflection on some of the kind of, and you mentioned it earlier, some of the kind of actual practices or some of the steps that people can take that are really, really invested in thinking more deeply about this and trying to figure out ways to support momentum.
Well, yeah, that's, I put all that stuff into part two in the book on doing. No, but let me just briefly then, since you ask, give you a little snapshot. And then, because I've been reviewing about 300 to 400 articles on social psychology and so anthropology and sociology about what actually works. And we know now the main five reasons why the climate messaging has failed. So it's the psychological barriers of distance, doom, dissonance, denial, and identity. The messages tend to crash. But how can we move beyond that? So it's making it work through social norms, social networks, and community-based initiatives. Because if you do climate, that's just one example. If one neighbor in a neighborhood puts solar panels on their roof, then the likelihood of the houses in nearby them goes up by orders of magnitude. So change happens not by some scientist telling that you're living in a bad way, you should change it, but it happens by believing that others are taking action. And that's the power of social networks. And then taking action on climate is much too complicated today, so we need to employ some behavioral economics and making it much more simpler to do the right choice. So you can do mindless and constructive choice rather than mindless and wasteful choices that we are doing today. And this is behavioral economics. And then I think we need more supportive frameworks, because the doom and the cost barrier that has kept us back, so the doom and the cost frames have created an emotional backlash. So I'm supporting frames such as the one you mentioned, Steve, with health, but also risk management and insurance, because insurance is coming out big, and thirdly through opportunities, that this is really an opportunity for our entire economy to shift its energy infrastructure. And there are billions and trillions of dollars to be made in this, and opportunities everywhere you look. So I try to bring the business people on board with this kind of frames. And then we need better storytelling, of course. And I just want to mention one that's coming up very strongly, and I was luckily called by the National Catholic Enquirer today to give an interview, because with the Pope's encyclical coming our way, we have a revival of the stewardship story, but also the quality of life and the happiness stories that we see are emerging are also very important stories to tell. So we shift our growth from maximizing a wasteful way of making GDP to maximizing people's quality of life. It's a new political story that's gaining momentum. And then finally, we need better signals, because people need feedback in order to see whether we are succeeding in shifting. Today, climate communications has over-focused on PPM, CO2 levels in the atmosphere. It's sea level rise in inches per decade and watt per meter of forcing. And these are signals that nobody can relate to. However, if we had signals that said, well, you know, in our neighborhood, now we have 10% more biking than last year, or we have suddenly 2% better air, we can see how we are shifting rather than just these global figures that only make us feel helpless. So by combining these five strategies for cultural transformation, we know we have evidence that each of these works, And it's really a matter of spreading that practice, the best practices. This is already happening in a lot of places in the world, but we need better storytellers and better communicators to get this knowledge implemented in communities. And I'm very happy to be here at the where you also have the community psychology. This is community psychology, as I see it, in terms of the climate issue. Mm. So I don't know if that was the answer to your question, Steve, but I just want to throw that one up there too.
Yeah, well, I got close. I really appreciate it.
But this is, you know, shifting modes from more existential into a pragmatic mindset. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know. Any more questions, Mary, or should we...
Any more questions? All right.
Yeah, Ed. Good.
I asked the first question. I have to ask the last.
Oh, yeah.
So, why is it that some cultures distinguish, again, as the ancient Greeks did, between air and ether? They have two words for it. There's air, A-E-R, in Greek, and there's ether.
Mm.
And ether actually had a long history. You know, ether, it persisted to really the Michelson-Morley experiment at the end of the 19th century. Phlogiston was actually, we think of it as chimerical, but it was an important factor. People believe there's something.
Mm.
There's not exactly air, but it's very diaphanous.
Mm.
It's very light. I just wondered, should we also think that there are two dimensions?
Mm.
That's just a question. I have no answer to this, air and ether.
I'd love to discuss this with you, Ed, much more. Two reflections. One, I think the way I understood ether was the kind of the aliveness or the vital energy in the air, right? And that was conceived as critical to kind of understand, for instance, fire, the way fire moved, the energy. And in James Hillman's essay, The Imagination of Air, from 1981, he looks at the death of the ether theory with the overtaking of the chemical revolution during the Enlightenment, and how that, because they now discovered oxygen. And oxygen was then replacing the ether in the natural sciences imagination of air. And there, because that was, oxygen also has a, I forgot that name, but you know, it took a long time before they actually managed to distinguish the element of oxygen. And then when they finally did it, the chemical tradition declared there was no longer a need for having ether to explain things. So that was how the idea of something alive or living in the air died. It was replaced by our chemical notion of oxygen. And now, you're right, we're trying maybe to revive it. And now I'm talking about the imagination as being this hosting of the patterns and the interconnections and the waves. Like when I'm speaking now, waves are making themselves move in this room, and we're all participating when you speak and I speak. And this imagination is the air's aliveness and its influence on us. So that's, to me, it's a revitalization, if you will, of the ether.
Nice. Well, you've done it for us. Thank you.
Okay. There's one question.
Sorry, I have a question. I came in a little bit late, so I don't know if you already touched on it. But I was wondering if you spoke to the various gods or goddesses that air is their element, like Oya, who is the Yoruba goddess of the winds and cemeteries. And I think specifically about the winds that come off the west coast of Africa and come into the Gulf, you know, at a certain time of the year.
Mm.
And I was wondering if you spoke to that. And then I'm also wondering, second question, I'm a Gemini, which is an air sign, and that's why I really wanted to come here to talk.
Oh.
I wanted to talk about that too, about the air.
Oh, these are wonderful topics, but I need another lecture, right? Because I picked out the aspect. In the book, I look particularly at the Navajo wind system, but I think all ancient cultures have had personifications of the winds. So the Greeks, for instance, had personifications of the west wind, the north wind, the south wind, and the east wind, and Norse mythology had it, and I'm sure your tech culture also had it, because these are very influential beings. They determine our day. If it's westerly or easterly, the days become very different. So, of course, it's more than human powers. And I think we need to restore that mode of relating to the air. The restoration of the imagination, as James Tillman is talking about. And we need to do the restoration of the imagination of the air.
We are hopeful that Tara's book is in the bookstore, in case you'd like a copy. And thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, pleasure. Pleasure. Thank you. Oh, thanks, Steve.
Oh, James will be so pleased that you're here. Yes. Thank you for being here. We're going to approach you. I would love for you to celebrate our 40th anniversary with us.
Oh, wow, what an honor.
Yes, I would love that. James would love it as well. Mary Ned will be a big part of it.
Oh.
It'll be a homecoming. Margot will be here.
So. That's very touching.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
You know, I love James.
I know.
He still lives here.
Believe me. Right? Right.
That's
so God.
Oh,
yeah.
Grateful.
Okay, cool. I'm going to run and teach.
Okay.
Restore myself.
Yes.
With the air between us all.
Yes.
Really great me. I'm so happy you're here.
Oh, wow.
Really? Yeah. Really cool.
Okay, Steve, we'll be in touch.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Oh.
I love this.
Okay, good.
So, we need to change the computer.
Oh, yeah, you were on, right?
That was very nice.
Yeah? Thanks. Fantastic.